euthanasia, or assisted dying, looks all set to become the next battleground in British politics. Many argue that the terminally ill should be allowed to arrange help to die with dignity. To others, it's simple. Life is sacred, and ending it is murder. With legislation now coming through Parliament, it's a debate that will last over the summer, to say the least. And it has started here at The Spectator with two of our editors, Douglas Murray and Sam Leith, fundamentally disagreeing. In this conversation, recorded in the editor's office, they try to understand why. Sam Leith is The Spectator's literary editor and Douglas Murray is its contributing editor. And if you enjoy the podcast to come, please do try the magazine at spectator.co.uk/voucher, where you can get 12 issues for £12, as well as a free £20 Amazon voucher. Here's Sam.
Well, I find myself, possibly as in accordance with my position as The Spectator's token hand-wringing liberal, in favour of assisted dying. But I want to be clear, really, on the narrowness of that position, which is to say, you know, if we're talking about this in the context of what's actually being discussed about going into law, the assisted dying bill is not a bill that allows us to euthanize the incapable. It's not the same as taking the decision to take the life of somebody else. And likewise, assisted suicide, i.e. able-bodied people who want to kill themselves, or people who are not suffering from a terminal illness who want to kill themselves, are kind of a separate argument. I mean, the scope of the assisted dying bill essentially says that you have to have, according to at least two doctors and a High Court judge, you have to be of sound mind, have less than 6 months to live. And at that point, it's something that becomes an option to you. And I think that's a very humane and reasonable position to take. And the reason I, liberal that I am, the fundamental reason why I'm in favour of this bill is a pretty kind of solid, I suppose, almost conservative position, which is to do with property rights. Most of the, you know, foundation of our common law and the liberties we enjoy are to do with the idea that your body and the labour that your body produces is your own. And it seems to me it follows from that that it shouldn't be, and, you know, abortion rights have come into this argument as well, it shouldn't be the business of the state to tell you what you can and can't do with your body. And if you're in a position where you very strongly, for good and intelligible reasons and of sound mind, wish to control the circumstances of your death, you should be entitled to. And I would think, on a basis of personal annoyance, I would feel it was bloody cheek if I was in that situation and the organs of the state told me it was their business, not mine.
Well, let me start by disagreeing with one particular thing, which is the idea that your body is your own and therefore you can do what you like with it. I personally don't agree with that. You may have a considerable amount of autonomy over your body, as we all do, but it's not just yours, and it's not just yours to give or take. Everybody around you, everybody you love, and more, has some involvement in what you decide to do with your body. And if you decide that you take the view that it is entirely your own choice and solely your choice, you have to, among other things, say, even with the objections of, for instance, your nearest and dearest, your loved ones, there's no right, as it were, to allow that to make an impact on it. It's my body, I can do what I want. And then there's a societal follow-on from that, the ripples out from it towards everybody else in society. What does it mean if we all decide we can do whatever we like with ourselves because of our own total personal autonomy? Which means that, for instance, the effect of somebody deciding at a certain stage of, yes, even a terminal illness, deciding to take their life.
It is only a terminal illness that we're talking about.
Well, we'll get on to that. Yeah. That even in the case of terminal illness, who knows what the ripple effects are there on everybody else in society who currently or at any stage in the future suffers from that same illness? We don't know. And I would submit that there are, at the very least, a lot of claims of ownership of a near type and of a further away type, which I just can't concede should be pretended away simply by the claim that it's mine to give, mine to take. But I think that there are several reasons why I have very strong feelings about this. The first is that I think that it's an issue which is being described as a right when that's at the very least debatable and a packaging issue, you might say. Secondly, there are very, very few issues that are anything like this one that we discuss. And I've been amazed, I think when I wrote about this for the Spectator last, Lord, the main proponent of euthanasia.
Faulkner.
Said to me when we had a discussion about it, said, I can't believe you're talking in such grandiose terms about this, as if one ought to talk about euthanasia or assisted dying as it's repackaged, in the same way you talk about proposals for VAT alteration or something like this. And it isn't. There's only one issue I can think of remotely similar seriousness, which is abortion. And I think it's a useful comparison for the following reason, which is that when abortion laws were changed in this country and every other country in the West, we were told why they were going to change, and there was a very good reason why they were going to change, which was the horror of backstreet abortionists and more. And today you end up in a position where, without very much pushback, other than from some Catholics, abortion is basically a means of contraception, which is, some people agree with, some people don't, but it's an amazing, amazing amount of terrain to cover in a very short space of a few decades. And I see very few reasons why the same kind of speed of shift wouldn't happen with euthanasia. You might say it's a slippery slope argument, but this, I can assure you, is a very, very slippery slope. I, some years ago, went to speak with euthanasia practitioners and others in Belgium and the Netherlands. I was amazed by the slippage that had happened. That it started off with all of the things that you've just said. My own body, at the very end of my life, with a terminal condition. And today, the campaign is for children to be able to do it without the authority of their parents, for people who are mentally ill, for people who are, in the phrase that I think translates from the Dutch into English, simply, quote, tired of life. Tired of life. And it moved. It moved. And everyone said, oh, don't get all slippery slope on us. It moved. Now if you have a mental illness in the Netherlands, you know, other people who have mental illnesses kill themselves with the approval of the state.
We're talking about a law on the statute book rather than direction of travel. I mean, I think, you know, the sort of thin end of the wedgery, the abortion case, it's a different procedure, it's a different argument. I mean, oddly enough, I'm much more sympathetic, actually, to the case against abortion or the than I am to this one, because there's always an argument at some point between conception and birth at which another body enters into it, and we argue over that. This isn't one such case.
Well, it's very... So if I say the two similarities are, if I say that, first of all, a comparably serious moral case to do with human life, and secondly, the window question. Very similar. The window between conception and potential abortion. It's not that different as a moral issue with the difference between the moment of the diagnosis of a terminal illness or the definition of what you describe as being a terminal illness, whether it's physical or mental, and the decision that you can then have euthanasia for that. It's not that different.
I would say it is rather different. I mean, the fact that we have two windows doesn't mean they're the same thing. And we're clearly looking at, in this case, more than one window or issue. I mean, there's sort of two separate, and they are analytically separate issues, one of which is the terminal illness, the other one of which is, at least in the way it's being framed in the assisted dying bill, whether or not the person is of sound mind. Hmm. And to sort of conflate those in a, you know, what about children? What about people who aren't of sound mind? What about, you know, people who are not capable of making these decisions? It's obviously impossible to prove a negative, but what we're talking about here is making a find an absolute distinction in law. Now, it may be that public opinion, you know, there's a sort of argument that, okay, two stages down the line, if we sign this into law, people will be pushing for...
Oh, without that, the morning after. That's what we learned from the Dutch and the Belgian experiences, which are not very different countries from ours, in their historic attitudes, in their religious inheritances and more.
And they've succeeded in changing the law to that extent?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's been a constant push. One of the most interesting things about the euthanasia movement in the Netherlands and in Belgium is every time there's always a next step.
But if there is always a next step, if you can always draw a continuum between one reasonable position and an unreasonable position that's a long way down the road, does that mean you should at no point take the reasonable position, that the only form of
bulwark
against that is a sort of absolutism?
But I don't concede that it's a reasonable position to start with, the assisted dying bill, for instance. But I would suggest that two very close countries, having gone through this, would, yes, be a very, very salutary case study, at the very least. It seems unlikely to me that if this, as I say, always having a next step happens in Belgium and happens in Holland, there's nothing innate about the British people that means we don't go for the next step as well. And as I say, there always is one. It's always a conflation first of physical towards mental illness. And by the way, may I add, we live in a society in this country where the government, among others, is committed to the idea that physical ailment and mental ailments are to be put on the same level pegging. That we are to treat mental illness with the same seriousness as physical illness.
But treating it with the same seriousness and responding to it in an identical way.
No, no,
is
I say
not
that
the same thing.
You can, of course, but you can completely see where the push comes, as I say, it has in two very close neighbouring countries. That the moment you say, we treat mental illness with at least as much seriousness as we do physical illness, and we are now conceding that there are people with terminal physical illnesses, what is the difference between that and a terminal psychological illness? And you get there. You get there earlier and earlier. It was a woman in her early 20s the other month in Belgium. Let me give you one example, pertinent to several other massive sociological changes at the moment. A case of somebody called Nathan Verhelst. You know this case in Belgium?
No, I don't know.
2013. Nathan Verhelst was only girl in a family of boys. Obviously grew up very unhappy about being a girl and had a very bullying set of parents. Attempts to change sex in the late 2000s on the Belgian state. The operations aren't very successful. There's a lot of scarring, as there is if you attempt to turn a woman into a man. And 2 years after the not very successful NHS surgery in Belgium, the Belgian state euthanizes Nathan Verhelst. At the age of, I think, 42. I think, by the way, that when future ages look back on this age and say, what the hell were they thinking? This case will be absolutely at the forefront, just as we look back on every other age and think, what the hell were they thinking? I mention this because there was one dogma of the age, the idea that you can change people like pieces of Lego from one sex to another and back again, if you'd like. Doesn't always work. Causes unbelievable agony. Imagine if you're a woman who had tried to have a penis grafted onto you through arm grafts and skin grafts and so on. You had terrible scarring. The photographs of this woman becoming a man at the beach show terrible scarring. Must have been absolutely unbearable, unlivable, actually. And the state had an option there. They had something to do. And I see...
We're straying a little far away from this.
I don't think we are. I don't think we are at all. My point is that the moment you start down this path, you have no idea where it'll lead, other than that there are always next steps. Lord Falkner may believe that he stops at step one, but the evidence is, from nearby countries, that step one is followed very rapidly by others. And I think, at the very least, I think that you might say, I know exactly how to put down an incredibly clear moral line to stop step two, step three, step four, and so on, all the way to the pill you take if you've become tired of life. You can say that you'd know exactly where you put it down, but you'd have to have a much better case than, I think Lord Falkner can stop it.
Well, I don't think you're saying, I think Lord Falkner can stop it. I mean, it's possibly a whole other argument, the question of, let's say, a democratic society in which public opinion shifts in a way we find alarming, which is what you're describing, maybe that is a bullet you have to bite. I mean, it seems to me you're putting... The bullet of public opinion changing and law going with it. I mean, it seems to me that your thin end of the wedgery, though I accept that that may be, you know, plausible if what you're describing is the case, but there again, is there a way of insulating us? You know, we may take a step that we think is right, but it's very paternalistic and it seems to me essentially anti-democratic to start by saying, right, step one, we've decided is okay, but we don't want to go to step five. And the danger is that step one will make people think differently and our democratically elected lawmakers will accommodate that body of public opinion and therefore We don't want that body of public opinion to emerge in the first place, so we don't take step one.
I actually think it's quite hard to claim that there's going to be massive public support for these steps. I don't know what the latest opinion polling is in this country, actually, do you?
Well, there's considerable public opinion support for step one, which is the step that's under argument at the moment. I want to briefly actually just refocus. You know, I mean, I'm not denying, but I'm parking, if you like, the terrifying other end of the wedge, but looking at step one. And I wanted to make two points in response to what you've said, one of which is that you're absolutely right that others have an interest in what we do with our bodies.
Yes.
The law as it is enshrines the idea that, of course, they do, and we exist in relation to others. We have our loved ones, we have, you know, and we'd assume that that same relationship would continue. Anyone who's taking this decision would take that decision in some form of consultation or negotiation with their loved ones and those around them. I mean, we have the rights to say, screw you, well, you're going to be miserable, but this is what I'm going to do.
Often the children don't agree.
Yes, but the law at the moment entitles me, with my sound body and theoretically sound mind, to empty my bank account, hop on an aeroplane to the other side of the world, leave my wife. I can do all sorts of things that will harm, damage and upset my loved ones. But the law recognises my right to do all that, my bodily autonomy and my agency. And it doesn't preclude me from causing upset or distress to my nearest and dearest. In fact, it takes almost no view on the matter at all. And I don't see why that should change when I'm terminally ill.
Although if you, for instance, disinherited people very suddenly at the end, the law could take a view on that.
There's a whole separate argument for the wills and probates experts. But, you know, in broad outline, the law gives me the right to do with my own body what I like, regardless of how it impacts on those around me, you know, with the, you know, Isaiah Berlin positive liberty ending where it meets the noses of others, but the emotions not so much. The abortion analogy used, I think, is interesting because I think there is, as well as the principle, or as I see it, principled argument of bodily autonomy and agency that I've outlined, there is a pragmatic issue, which is the same pragmatic issue, I think, that drove abortion reform, which is, again, a conservative position. We live in a sort of very much a free market position. Euthanasia or assisted dying, you know, they said at the time, legalising abortion won't stop abortions happening, it will simply make them safer. At the moment, we are not able, you know, for good reasons to do with local politics, able to prohibit assisted dying worldwide. So we're in a situation where those who want to get it and can afford to, which obviously, you know, privileges, if that's the word, certain groups of people, can travel to Dignitas or wherever they like, which means that this is happening. It's much harder for them and much more unpleasant for them and much more expensive and traumatising for their heirs and relicts. And that seems to me to be a pragmatic argument in favour of saying if it's going to be possible for people to do it anyway, they should be allowed to do it here in a way that impacts.
Make death easier to access.
Make death easier to access, exactly.
What a beautiful slogan.
You should have off death.
Beautiful slogan.
Consumer body.
First of all, I think that on these sorts of things, it's not unwise to make these things difficult, actually. Harder than they need to be, not just easier. There's a good argument the other way. Let me give you an example. I spoke once to a euthanasia doctor who told me, very frankly, I said, with patients who are terminally ill, who, for instance, suffer from degenerative illnesses, muscular degenerative illnesses, which mean that they cannot sign the form to die when they are at their worst. They sign it in advance, which is not dissimilar to what's being suggested here. And I asked this doctor, how can you be sure? How can you be sure when they've signed the form and they degenerate a bit further that you are definitely killing, or however one wants to euphemize that.
Euthanize.
How are you sure when you do that you are killing them and they want to die? And he said, I can't be sure. And I asked, do you think you've ever euthanized somebody who didn't actually want to die? Then he said, yes, I'm certain of it. And I'm sure in my experience, I'm sure in yours, with elderly relatives, friends and others who are at the ends of their lives, quite often they will say, I don't want to get to X stage. And they are absolutely certain they will never get to X stage. And if they ever got near X stage, they would be flying off to Switzerland or whatever they can do. And they get to X stage and the stage beyond, and they still want to live. It isn't an unknown.
No, these are hard cases, and I can see you fall then into a very considerable kind of philosophical gulf, don't you? How much can you bind your future self? And I agree with you that...
Can you imagine?
You generally should not be able to.
Lying in a bed, yes. You signed the death form, but you don't want to die today, but you do. On the state.
Well, at least it's on the state. Getting something for free after all those...
It's the other thing about it. It's
contributions
the sheer
over the years.
Effing bureaucratic awfulness of it. The form-filling, the euphemising that'll go on, the little bureaucratic creep that'll go on when we're talking about whether... When we're talking about whether or not people should die when their bodies give up or when a form agrees. And by the way, one other thing, which is that countries that have euthanasia laws tend to become very lax with end-of-life care. In fact, countries where I've spoken to people who involve in euthanasia always say how admirable and good British medicine is with the last stages of life. That there is this presumption that currently doctors, well, among other things, first of all, as I say, there's this, the moments at the end when people are in hospice or whatever. I think in my own observation, doctors do know what to do and can, without euthanizing people, make judgments and do make judgments about how to alleviate pain. And it's different from euthanasia.
When you say how to, I mean, that sounds itself like a euphemism of the sort you deplored, how to alleviate. I mean, of course, doctors are alleviating pain at the end of palliative care doctors. Do you mean bumping up the morphine in such a way as well?
They might increase morphine doses because of the pain of the patient and so on. I mean, this is, everybody knows, you know, cases of, and doctors know how to tread exceptionally carefully within that terrain. But this is the very, very last stages. But as I say, I mean, I'd rather have good palliative care and be an admired country for palliative care on the NHS rather than a country admired for very efficiently dispatching its elderly on the form's date.
Well, I mean, it doesn't sound to me like you're actually drawing that much of a distinction there, because...
No, I'm saying that it's already within the competency of doctors to make sure that the pain which people rightly fear want to alleviate is alleviated at the most extreme end.
It's not, as I understand it, but I'm not a medical expert, in certain cases. I mean, I remember the very plangent case of Bob Cole a couple of years ago. They were not able to alleviate the pain such that, I mean, we like the idea that well, it's fine, because actually towards the end of your life, you're always, you know, high on morphine and, you know, why would anyone want to die? And, you know, they're enjoying themselves almost. But sometimes they can't. Sometimes the only way, I mean, I remember with Bob Cole, I was saying, you know, the only thing that will, you know, we just have to hope that you get a lung infection and, you know, drown in your own blood, because that will finish you off. We can't do more for you. I mean, if what you're talking about is doctors who, to a certain extent, on a nod and a wink, as you say, ease the path, I'm not completely against that, but I would much prefer to have a say in it rather than having, you know, relying, as if you like, on your unelected bureaucrats with their morphine.
Or the elected ones, they're just as dangerous.
Or the elected ones, yes, but they're elected.
You're an atheist, aren't you?
I'm an atheist. Yeah.
So this isn't an argument against sanctity. And if I can say so, we probably then both have quite a significant moral challenge ourselves, which is shared by most people of our time, which is how might you form an idea of the sanctity of the human soul or the human life in a non-religious context? Seems to me a very, very important moral job of our time.
Assuming that we think that sanctity is the desideratum.
What else would it be?
Well, I think we could... I think you'd need to unpack what sanctity means. And I think, I mean, I would argue that, for instance, and in this instance, if you're talking about the sanctity of life, you'd think, why do do we regard it as something that's sacred, whatever that means? And I would say it is because it belongs to the individual who owns it.
No, I would disagree. I would say it because it's something very, very deep we intuit about ourselves. And we also know that in the absence of the concept, however you might define it, you unleash hell. If you decide that human life is not deserving of something like sanctity, then you
special protection
or someone else can do whatever the hell they want. And that isn't a minimal argument. It's not a footnote argument. It's one of the most important things in our civilization. Do we regard people as in and of themselves sacred in some way? Or do we not? And if we don't, you can do whatever you want. And we know what that means. And so, as I say, I would favour something like the idea of sanctity. We could come up with another term if we can come up with one better.
We can agree that human life is important.
No, more than important. More than important. It's not just important. It's everything. And we can't sum it up as if it's something we'd just rather have if we can.
Okay. I'll settle for that. But, I mean, you know, we'll end up in the Swedish trolley problem, won't we? You know, if it's sacred, and if every life is sacred, and if sanctity is itself indivisible and infinite, the sort of calculations that we make every day in our politics and our resource management and our decisions about whether or not to go to war, if you simply say life is sacred, you aren't in any way getting a purchase on the fact that we make decisions that impact on life, not only the quality of life, the likelihood of life.
You can have both running at the same time, because this isn't... You could concede, for instance, that viewing life with something like sanctity, viewing it as having something like sanctity about it, would be at the very least the most important aspiration, knowing that you're likely to fail in fulfilling that aspiration at times. Doesn't seem to be a bad place to start. And I can think of very, very few things that hit so fundamentally at the idea of human life being in some way sacred. Sacred enough to do everything possible within your technological, medical power to keep it going as long as you can. I can think of nothing more likely to erode that idea than deciding that you should introduce a way to have people with the state's approval decide when they end life.
It's a very odd form of sanctity, it seems to me, that says that the sanctity of your life, that abstract good, is more important than the individual life itself, and that the individual life itself and that the person who's living it and possibly suffering it in all sorts of agonies is less important than the preservation of this concept, however nebulous it may be, however important we might see it as.
Because I say several things, but the first is the impact that this is always going to have on everybody else in the society. I mean,
but in what way does my decision to end my life have an impact on everyone else in society? I mean, if, as an able-bodied person, I commit suicide, I'm within my rights,
yes,
and
oh
it has
my
an impact.
God. You know. Well, a very good example. When somebody commits suicide, they destroy the lives of everybody around them. They create something absolutely unmendable in everyone who loved them. Everybody. Family, friends.
So why does the law not prohibit suicide?
Well, we still have the idea of it being, in some way...
We agree it's a bad thing.
A bad thing, okay. But the ripple effects from any suicide on everybody... I mean, why do the children of people who commit suicide have a higher propensity for it?
Yes, we're absolutely... We both agree that it's a very bad thing.
I'm saying it's more than a bad thing. Well, because we have taken the view that to punish upon punishment on it is an unnecessary further burden. But my own view is that society should take a very negative view about suicide, should certainly not view it as being, you know, one option open to you, because, as I say, of this fact that it injects something into everybody around the person that they will never mend for the rest of their days. And if that is the case with suicide, I cannot see that when you get to a period at the end of somebody's life, however long or short you decide, or Lord Falkner decides, or anyone in the House of Lords decides that that period should be, that it would have zero ripple effect on everybody else.
No, I absolutely agree.
Right, so it must have a ripple effect.
And,
what is the ripple effect? That's what I want to get my finger. What is the ripple effect on everybody else if you decide, or the government decides, that it becomes legal at the end of somebody's life?
No, the government decides you're entitled to decide.
Okay, but yeah. The government decides that you are entitled to decide that at a certain point at the end of your life, you can decide this. What is the ripple effect from that, in your view?
What, the ripple effect societally,
on everybody
or the
else.
Ripple effect on...
On everybody else, first around the person and then on the rest of society.
I wouldn't presume to think we should arbitrate for the ripple effect on the rest of society.
Guess.
What, guess?
Yeah.
Well, the people around you are going to be sad, which, in context of the assisted dying bill, that's going to hit them one way or another. And this isn't, I should say, taken in a vacuum, because we are, you know, to move away from the suicide example, which is, you know, we're talking about able-bodied people with plenty of life left to live. Committing suicide, that's a sort of slight red herring, because...
Not a red herring, it's a relation.
Sorry, it's a relation, yes, it's a relation. But in the case of the assisted dying, if we follow the stipulations of the bill, you know, it's when we know you've only got 6 months left to live. And so that itself is, it's not in a vacuum. There is a ripple effect on the people around you of the fact you are terminally ill. And I think many people who have experienced this would argue that the ripple effect of your dying on your own terms might be considerably less than the ripple effect for your family of watching you suffer horribly for a very long period of time. So I don't think it's an entirely neutral question. I mean, one way or another, we are already in the shit. We're already in a place where things are pretty horrible for those around you. The ripple effect on the rest of society, I don't quite know how you'd quantify that, because it seems to me, I mean, at least initially, in your thin end of the wedge arguments, you were suggesting it would encourage the rest of society to think this was a great thing and that a public opinion would shift.
No. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that I know that campaigning bodies always have a next step, and they will always get to the next step if they can. And they will push for it the day after this bill, as they've pushed for it in every other campaign.
Campaigning bodies, you mean in the sense that, say, an organisation like Dignity in Dying, you think has a hidden agenda beyond what they say they're campaigning for, and that they want...
I wouldn't like to name specific groups for obvious reasons, but for instance, the main group in the Netherlands that campaigned for assisted dying, as it was first of all called, yeah, in the 1970s when they started making the argument, they were actually a eugenics-related body. They argued for killing the well, and they decided to shift the argument because they've noticed that didn't work that well, public opinion-wise. And they started at the other end instead. But my gosh, they've moved well to their first principles in the years since. Very well. And I have to say, it's extremely hard, I can see, to work out precisely societally what the ripple effect is.
Well, it seems to me very hard, obviously, to argue against an argument which presumes on motives and presumes on a future direction of travel,
a presumption. I'm saying it's always a case.
You say they'll always be pushing for the next step.
Yes. So it's worth considering where that happens, where they go. And as I say, if you're not absolutely sure in yourself that you and Lord Falkner and the other people inclined to this argument know exactly how to put the sluices down around that, I'd be very, very wary about beginning the argument. But let me return to the point I wanted to make, which is societal effects on it. My own view would be that has become that, I mean, there is something very profound it does in a society, a set of things it does in a society, of which the step we're talking about is, as I say, I think the first, but not the last stage. It changes people's attitude towards themselves, certainly. It subtly shifts it. It shifts it in your favour of I am myself. I am my own owner and sole proprietor, and nobody else has a right to tell me what to do with my body. It definitely pushes in that direction. It takes away something of the communal act of living, I think. I think it bookends life in a way which is, at the very least, something which I would say makes life shallower.
But these are some very abstract and intangible, personal positions, some of which are aesthetic as well. And it seems to me that's one of my, you know, sort of bugbears in this argument, is that a lot of the time it's the sort of arguments against are focused on what ifs and probablys.
That's because we haven't done it yet.
Yes.
Right?
But they're also focused
on... We're not going to be able to focus on...
abstract ideas about sanctity and autonomy that it seems to me run against or run over the individual feelings of the people involved.
Well, not all the people involved. Some of the people involved. But to go back to the point, if you have something you haven't done yet, you're going to have to be talking in hypotheticals. And if you're talking about something as important as deciding when people are allowed to die, you're likely to be talking in fairly sweeping terms, aren't you? I mean, we're not going to be able to talk in terms of Amendment 13C if we're talking about this. So, yes, we will have to talk in some way in sweeping, abstract terms.
But it seems to me that you're describing what will happen in terms of, if you like, corporate psychology as a result of this. And I don't... I mean, surely we're having this argument because people collectively feel a certain way about this issue. That feeling wasn't kind of cooked up in a gullible populace by a collection of eugenicists.
No. I mean, I suppose, well, let me try to put it into slightly more concrete, let's say, philosophical terms, but what's probably the most significant statement of the religious inheritance which you and I, like everyone else in this country, have imbibed to some degree, whether or not we follow its claims. Choose life.
I think that's train spotting, isn't it?
Mm-mm. Choose life that you and your descendants might live. It's an unbelievably important inheritance, that. It doesn't, by the way, certainly my own observation, exist in every society in history, even as an aspiration, let alone as a command. Choose life that you and your descendants might live is one very, very big thing to decide to caveat. It's a very foundational belief to decide to erase.
It's not a straightforward expression either. As you point out, it's an imperative. And choose life implies you can choose the opposite. Is it an invitation or an injunction or a, you know, command unto death? And likewise, we should again return in my boring old way to the actual argument under consideration, which is we're talking about choosing life or not choosing life when that choice has already been substantially taken away from us.
By the events of nature.
Yes. You know, we're not talking about allowing people to, you know, go in for assisted dying until they really are on the threshold of death itself anyway.
Well, that doesn't counter what I just said, which is that in every situation where you can choose life, it's a very profound, fundamental moral injunction, commandment. And as I say, I think that neither you nor I nor anyone else can fully guess what happens when a society that has generally run on that injunction being significant decides that, in fact, there's a new parenthesis you can add to it, thanks to the House of Lords. But let me add one other thing.
Well, it doesn't say live, it says choose life.
Yes, which...
Which does incorporate that parenthesis, doesn't it?
No, I would say that choose life brackets unless you're quite close to the end and then you could sign a form the NHS will give you and you could choose to die sooner, is I think I would add that parenthesis with great care, if at all. And my own obviously inclination is not at all. The other thing is, there is a view, and by the way, this is an extremely, the point I'm about to make is a very hard one for some people to accept, so I flag it up with waivers.
I'll do my best.
with waivers. And actually, I'm not saying that you can't. I know that certain people take the point I'm about to make, if they've been recently close to somebody at the very end stages and have wondered about whether or not this is the right path, find this a difficult point to accept. But I would suggest, I think I said this in my piece in The Spectator a few years ago, I would suggest that there are other injunctions, inheritances, something like it that we've had, some of which we're not always aware that we've inherited as ideas, which also run counter to the idea that we should start down the path which you advocate. And I would say, if I could sum it up, it would be in something like the lines in Lear, which you get in another version in Hamlet, don't you? Man must endure his going hence, even as his coming hither. Why does this line always stand out? Because there is something in it which I would suggest we recognise, which is, again, it's done in the Bible in different version, which is, the whole thing isn't easy. And it requires endurance at the beginning, throughout, and definitely the end. And that is an accurate, I'm not saying desirable, but an accurate depiction of what life is. It's to be endured. And you could decide that...
You could argue from the same premises that various of the ungodly innovations we've come up with over the years, such as the invention of anaesthetic or antibiotics,
sure,
are themselves a dangerous assault on this principle that life should be endured, and the suffering is an important part of it.
No, if alleviation of suffering means alleviation of needless suffering during life, that's, I think, a very different thing from deciding to say that at the end stage, what is currently being described as assisted dying, usually better described as euthanasia, that is merely a similar type of alleviation of suffering to, for instance, taking, paracetamol, is... Anyhow, to return to the point I was trying to make...
I'm just putting mind of another slightly less highbrow quote. It's Arthur Hugh Clough, "Thou shalt not kill, but needst not strive officiously to keep alive."
Anyhow, I think that these thoughts go very deep within a culture and very deep within a society. And they help a lot of people through a lot of very bad times. And there are particular views of life which we've inherited, and which I would argue in a religious and in a non-religious context find one of their most fundamental underminings in the whole practice of euthanasia. That it fundamentally shifts and alters our perception, not just of life, but of ourselves, of what we're doing, of purpose. It puts a radically different spin on everything. And if it was just about mildly...
Your view of the world is so anxiously held and so weak that it can be entirely changed. That you think everybody else's will be entirely changed.
I'm afraid
by this shift in the law.
I'm afraid the history of our species just in the last century alone suggests to me that, yes, we should be unbelievably wary of even very minor shifts. Yes. Yes. It's not hard at all to do away with a concept like sanctity of human life. Not hard at all. It happened in country after country last century for every different political direction. It happened from every direction religiously as well, religiously and non-religiously. It's incredibly easy to do, incredibly easy to lose something like that and not know how to get it back. Yes, I worry about that.
Well, I think we're probably going to have to agree to disagree at that point.
And that's where they ended it. If you'd like to read the magazine feature that came from this, there is a link in the descriptions. And if you enjoyed listening to Sam Leith, then please do tune in to his weekly books podcast, where he speaks to leading names in publishing. Thanks for listening, and do join us again tomorrow on Spectator Radio.